this threat to the physical and economic security of low-wage workers is essentially the tip of the trickle-down economics spear.
When you raise the price of employment, guess what happens? You get less of it.
The only thing that is true about the claim that if wages go up, employment will go down, is that if people like me can get people like you to believe it, it will work out very well economically for me.
From the offices of Civic Ventures in downtown Seattle, this is The Other Washington, a podcast on policy and politics from outside the Beltway.
Way outside the Beltway.
Far from the pundits and politicos who dominate the national debate. I'm David Goldstein.
And I'm Paul Constant.
And each episode, we'll be taking you on a deep dive into a single policy issue, explaining how it works,
how it doesn't,
and how conventional politics often gets in the way of implementing effective policy. And what better way to kick off The Other Washington than to focus on an issue on which Washington State has been leading the nation the past couple years, the minimum wage.
The $15 an hour minimum wage.
No, our living wage isn't very good, so it's probably about time that they raised it, but I don't know what the best solution is.
You know, the economy, everything is coming up, the prices, you know, we need it.
Last year, Seattle passed our nation's first $15 minimum wage.
Well, actually, SeaTac passed one first.
But Seattle was the first major city to pass $15, setting off a wave of minimum wage hikes nationwide.
San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York City.
My friends, let us commit today to go forward from this place, energized, unified, and committed to bringing our crusade to every corner of the state of New York, our crusade for economic justice.
Even our nation's capital, the other Washington, is expected to pass a $15 ordinance soon.
Today, we send a very loud and clear message to the United States Congress, to the President of the United States, and to corporate America. And that is, all of our workers from coast to coast need at least $15 an hour.
But to fully appreciate Washington's contribution to the minimum wage battle, you have to go all the way back to 1905. When the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a New York state law limiting working hours at bakeries violated the workers' right to contract under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And it was this Lochner decision, named after the bakery owner who brought the suit, that the court cited in tossing out minimum wage laws over the next 30 years.
So how did the tide eventually turn toward a sensible work week and minimum wage then?
Well, the Great Depression. In 1933, with the nation suffering from severe deflation, President Franklin Roosevelt signs the National Industrial Recovery Act, including the authority to enact industry-specific minimum rates of pay. This goes before the court, and again it's thrown out by a Supreme Court largely dominated by conservative justices.
Damn activist judges.
Damn activist judges, that's right. So this is important because this is where politics comes to play when we're talking about policy. Because what Roosevelt did next was he campaigned for re-election, largely running against the Supreme Court. Sound familiar, Republicans? In 1936, he wins in a landslide. Then the next year, another minimum wage case comes before the Supreme Court. Guess from where?
Washington?
Washington State had passed a minimum wage just for women, but this time, faced with Roosevelt's electoral mandate and his threat to pack the bench with four additional justices, a single conservative justice switches sides and votes to uphold the Washington State law. And with this, the Lochner era comes to an end. In 1938, Congress passes the Fair Labor Standards Act. So now we have a federal minimum wage for the first time ever. So the first minimum wage was only 25 cents an hour, but it's there. And more importantly, in the post-Lochner era, regulations like these are not only possible, but common. And so our whole modern regulatory era grows out of this overturning of the Lochner decision.
So we went from 25 cents to $15 an hour.
Right. Though that's not as big a leap as you might imagine. 25 cents adjusted for inflation would be about $5 today. By 1949, Congress had raised it to 75 cents. That's about $7.50 in today's dollars. By 1968, we were up to the equivalent of about $10 an hour. And what's interesting about this is that what I'm talking about is adjusted for inflation. But from the time the minimum wage was first passed and approved by the court in 1938 until 1968, when it reached its inflation-adjusted peak, they weren't raising it with inflation. They were raising it with worker productivity. As productivity increased and our nation grew wealthier, minimum wage workers saw their real buying power going up with everybody else. Until sometime in the late 1960s, early 70s, we severed that connection between the minimum wage and the economy.
So if we were to keep the minimum wage tied to productivity, where would we be right now?
About $22 an hour.
Wow.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by.
So that puts $15 in perspective. It's actually not this outrageous leap from the current federal $7.25 an hour, but rather kind of a compromise between where it is now and where it would have been had we not changed policy.
I want to create jobs so that you don't have to worry about the minimum wage. They're doing a great job, and they're making much more than the minimum wage. But I think having a low minimum wage is not a bad thing for this country.
Let's have a debate about growth and what generates growth, because a minimum wage law, as good as it may sound at the outset, is not the way to do it.
A 50 cents an hour increase over 3 years, which is what I'm proposing. So we would have a minimum wage which would be roughly in the area of what it's been historically, about 5% of wages.
I'm Zach Silk, and I'm the president of Civic Ventures. There was a political opportunity and appetite to raise the wage much more dramatically, to have a real impact on people's lives. And that was an important switch for the movement. Prior to that, there had been a tendency to talk yourself down. So, in other words, to convince yourself to go smaller, more incremental rather than bigger and bolder. And it turns out that both the general electorate, but also probably equally importantly, workers were inspired by a much higher number. And I think that was the big switch. And that was created by the context of millions of people working these jobs, working nearly full-time or over full-time in minimum wage jobs.
It's a lot easier with that bump, though. I mean, I don't have to get help with my bills anymore. I can actually go buy groceries for the week. I mean, it's pretty nice.
The logic of the advocates who'd been working on minimum wage, their logic was a very incremental logic. This idea that we're going to get to larger minimum wages by fighting small and chipping away over a long period of time. But that had left them with really unfavorable terrain where they were fighting for these tiny little increases and never asking for something bigger and bolder. And the truth of the matter is that when you're trying to build movements and you're trying to score political victories, large political victories, you need to inspire people to come to that. And I think that that was the difference between asking for 15 and asking for a 10 cent increase. Both of which are politically viable in terms of you can win on them, but only one of them is going to lead to a large popular movement that can change the whole conversation in the country, which is what we've done with 15.
Meet one millionaire, venture capitalist Nick Hanauer. Nick's in a fortunate place. He's not only rich, but as the first non-family investor in Amazon.com, we suspect he's really rich.
The billionaire who says tax the rich now says he wants a $15 minimum wage. Here he is, Nick Hanauer.
Well, we're joined now from Seattle by Nick Hanauer. Yes. Forbes magazine saying that your plan is near insane.
So let's talk about solutions. Obviously, you chose $15, a $15 minimum wage, as your main issue. Forbes called you crazy for that. So $15, was this a policy decision or a tactical decision?
Well, I mean, Just to be clear, it was more than Forbes that called us crazy when we started on this quest. But so once you recognize that it's wages that fuel the economy and recognize what's happened to wages over the last 20 or 30 years, then, you know, your brain wants to find the quickest and easiest way to generate more wages for the most people. And the minimum wage is a very simple, effective, and efficient way to do that. To paraphrase my own words, you know, that the true job creators in a capitalist economy are middle-class consumers. And when they thrive, so does everything else. And once you recognize the economy as an ecosystem, as essentially a system of a positive feedback loops, it becomes quite clear that despite what orthodox economists say, rising economic inequality isn't good for the economy. It's actually bad for it. That the thing that drives both economic growth and economic activity are wages, and that when wages rise, so does business activity and hiring, and which in turn creates a feedback loop which leads to more business activity and more hiring.
What should the minimum wage be?
For me personally, yeah. 15, 20
why
bucks.
Why not 50?
If it really worked, why not raise it to $35 or $40 an hour?
If it's all that good, why stop at 15? Let's go to 100 bucks.
Why not raise the minimum wage to $100,000?
If you're in the old paradigm, of course, the sort of trickle-down orthodox economic paradigm, the only reason you would ever raise the minimum wage is because you felt sorry for people. It was sort of a charity or pity gesture. And that's why the people who had been sort of fighting that fight on both the right and the left never thought about raising it more than about 50 cents an hour. But once you recognize that higher wages for workers will generate more business activity and make the economy work better, now you're looking for the optimal level that you should raise it. And what we realized was that if the minimum wage had tracked productivity gains over the last 30 years, it'd be like $21.50 or $22. If it had merely tracked inflation, it would be $10.70 or $11. And so $15 was this round number in between those two numbers that we knew the economy could accommodate and that would generate growth and benefits for everybody. Let me just make another precise political point, which was that when I first started thinking about this problem, I talked to a bunch of people. I talked to my friend Robert Reich, former labor secretary, about this, and he warned me. He very specifically warned me. He said, "Nick, you're going to get in a world of trouble." I certainly did in my Senate hearings, because people would say, "Well, if X is good, then why not 50X? If 10 is good, then why not 20 or 50 or 100 would be the principal attack that people would make. So it was very important for us to pick a number and root it in an economic reality, which were these two numbers between the $10 inflation number and the $20 and the $20 productivity number to be able to defend against that attack. At the same time, you've got the millions and millions of people earning the federal minimum wage of $7.25 or $2.13 plus tips for tipped workers, who all of whom require food stamps and Medicaid and all these other government programs to survive. And that part, you know, just speaking as a business person, it's just a moral and economic abomination to me. It is ludicrous for giant profitable corporations like McDonald's and Walmart and others to pay workers these wages that require taxpayers to make up the difference. And so 15 just is a conservative, sensible number, and one that we felt strongly would benefit the public in a variety of ways.
I work at Domino's Pizza. I do pretty much everything except delivery. I've worked for the company a little over 6 years, minimum wage plus tips.
I have two boys and I'm a single mom that doesn't get child support, so that would help me a lot with my bills and everything. I don't have to rely on people tipping me.
This threat to the physical and economic security of low-wage workers is essentially the tip of the trickle-down economics spear. And it's what rich people have done to poor people to manipulate them for as long as we've had capitalism. But the simple truth is that the minimum wage has been raised nationally dozens of times. The minimum wage has been raised in various states many, many, many dozens of times, there has never been this negative effect, which is because when workers have more money, businesses have more customers and need more workers. Now, on an individual basis, look, there are some companies that have predicated their business models on exploiting workers, on paying workers poverty wages. And those businesses may fail in the face of higher wages. But the great thing about capitalism is someone will swoop in and figure out how to do it a different way. And that's why aggregate employment always increases. So, you know, this claim is just, it's just utter nonsense. It's a threat. The only thing that is true about the claim that if wages go up, employment will go down, is that if people like me can get people like you to believe it, it will work out very well economically for me.
Nationwide protests over decent wages spilling into the streets of New York tonight, snarling traffic and shutting down roads.
Hundreds of protesters out for a second day today calling for a higher minimum wage.
This isn't just a McDonald's thing. I was just talking to someone from churches, people here from Popeyes, Walmart, nurses, healthcare workers, even some part-time professors at the universities are part of this.
You could not turn on a major TV outlet. You couldn't turn on the radio. I was driving around from strike line to strike line all day, and I was listening to AM news radio. The Seattle strike wasn't going to get coverage on national NPR, but on the local news stations, it was everywhere.
By the thousands tonight, they marched and skirted the...
My name's David Rolfe, and I'm the president of SEIU 775. That was really the first public compression point around 15 in Seattle. In May 29th, the night of May 29th, when Carolyn walked off the job at the Taco Bell in Ballard.
My employer was stealing my wages.
Caroline DeRocher says in the 6 months she worked the closing shift at the Ballard Taco Bell, her manager routinely clocked her out 1 hour after closing time. The actual work, she says, would go on longer, an extra 15 minutes to 3 hours of unpaid time.
Scrubbing floors and doing dishes and cleaning bathrooms and putting away food till 3, 4, sometimes 5 in the morning.
The day-long strikes on the 30th, and these two-track campaigns were really operating 15 miles apart, ultimately led and funded by the same organizations, but had really each stumbled onto the fight for 15 in their own different way.
I'm Sterling Harders, and I am vice president at SEIU 775, and I ran the field campaign for the SeaTac minimum wage. Airport workers at SeaTac Airport had been fighting for the better part of a decade to increase their wages. I think it's important to remember that all of those jobs at SeaTac Airport, lots of them, used to be good jobs, in many cases, good union jobs. And starting in the year 2000 and through the middle part of that decade, in particular, Alaska Airlines contracted out a lot of those jobs, and folks who had been making what was a decent living wage were suddenly laid off and offered the opportunity to come back at their jobs, making oftentimes very close to minimum wage. So workers at the airport and around the airport had been trying to organize to make improvements for years. And they'd been fighting to improve their wages, and they'd been fighting to form a union. And after years and years of fighting with the port and fighting with the airlines and fighting with the various subcontractors that they worked under, they finally said, enough is enough. And they decided to take their fight to the people of SeaTac, to the voters in SeaTac, and to let them decide whether or not workers at SeaTac Airport and around SeaTac Airport deserve to make a living wage.
And so this was a pretty innovative strategy in that SeaTac is just actually a pretty small town which the airport is situated in. It incorporated around the airport, right?
That's right. SeaTac is a fairly small town. There are less than 30,000 people who live in the city of SeaTac. Before we started, there were only 11,000 registered voters in the entire city. So one of the strategies that was key to the workers' ultimate victory in SeaTac was that we went out and registered nearly 1,000 new voters in the city of SeaTac, including increasing the electorate by nearly 10%, which proved to be absolutely key in passing a minimum wage increase at the ballot in SeaTac.
So was the original intention to actually pass something at the ballot, or was it a threat to try to get Alaska and its contractors to the table?
You know, I think that the workers there were determined to get to increase wages one way or the other. And when the port wouldn't do it and Alaska wouldn't do it, they did whatever they needed to do. And this was our next best option.
So had they come to the table, would you still have run the initiative?
If Alaska Airlines would have come to the table and would have negotiated and would have agreed to pay their workers $15 an hour, then right. We wouldn't have needed to.
So we have Alaska Airlines to thank.
You know, I think we have a lot of people to thank. I think we have the fact that Alaska wasn't willing to do anything. I think that we have the fact that the port continued to refuse to acknowledge that they had any responsibility. And I think that we can thank the contractors, the individual contractors, for repeatedly refusing to recognize their employees' rights to form a union.
I'm going to rewind. November 2012 turns out to be a pretty magical moment. Two other things happened that month. There was a frustrating conversation with some folks in the executive branch of the federal government about how going to $9 was too high and might disrupt the recovery. And I repeated that story to Nick Hanauer, who then got up and repeated it in front of 200 high-powered sort of democratic and progressive movement donors and activists at a conference in D.C. And he said, you know, we ought to be aiming for $15, unaware that there was about to be a strike 7 days later for $15 in Brooklyn. And unaware of either of those facts, a California conservative Silicon Valley billionaire named Ron Unz, who was the publisher of a journal named American Conservative, he published an article that said, you know, conservatives should be for a $12 to $15 national minimum wage.
I think it makes much more sense for businesses to pay their own workers rather than to shift the burden to the American taxpayer.
And if you're worried about losing jobs, don't, because every job that can be automated will be, and every job that can be offshored will be, and that's going to happen regardless of whether the wage is $7 or $20. And so from a very unlikely place on the political spectrum, we heard this. And all of that came... All of it, the role of people like Nick, the role of the fast food strikers, the role of the airport workers, and all collided with the electoral calendar in Seattle in the year 2013, where we had a mayor's race and we had a number of city council races. And, you know, for an issue that probably no one had ever bothered taking a poll on, should the minimum wage be $15, yes or no, in late 2012, it became the number one issue in the elections in 2013.
Seattle's newly elected city council member, Shama Sawant, is blasting Boeing and big businesses. Sawant won a Seattle city council seat as a socialist alternative candidate. She's pushing a $15 an hour minimum wage for Seattle workers, and she's predicting big businesses will attack her to make sure that doesn't happen.
So why don't we start? You tell me your name.
Shama Sawant.
And you are?
I'm on the Seattle City Council and I'm a member of Socialist Alternative, a nationwide organization of economic and social justice activists.
So you are a socialist.
I am a socialist.
A Marxist.
Yes.
A Trotskyist.
Yes.
And you were elected how many times to the Seattle City Council?
Twice.
So the first time was in 2013. Nobody expected you to win. And what did you run on?
We ran very prominently on the banner of $15 an hour, but we were also calling for affordable housing and taxing the rich.
And
that was the same year, if you recall, the labor movement had launched its campaign for a voter initiative on $15 an hour in SeaTac, and we were, of course, in solidarity with that movement. And, you know, I personally went... When I was running as a candidate for city council, I personally went to the SeaTac city council as well to testify in favor of that $15 an hour, saying that if we won it in SeaTac, it would provide the momentum for our victory in Seattle, which is exactly what happened. I can tell you the reason Socialist Alternative took on the banner of $15 an hour in 2013 is because in the fall of 2012, when the workers, fast food workers in Manhattan first walked out on, you know, on the demand of $15 and a union, and we could see that it was starting to be taken up by labor unions, by SEIU, which played an absolutely critical role in this, in bringing this to a head, we could see that there was something about $15 an hour. And I'll tell you what that something is. It's a kind of political demand which seems substantial enough that it's worth going out and fighting for. Organized labor was the backbone of the SEATAC initiative. Without that, it would not, first of all, it would not have even come to the forefront because it was taken up seriously by organized labor. It's also an example of how, if we are to really win a real momentum against this entrenched inequality all over the country, labor has to fight on issues that affect all workers, not just unionized workers. And that is exactly what they did in SEATAC.
My name is Tim Burgess. I'm the president of the Seattle City Council. In a neighboring city, SeaTac, Washington, there was a ballot measure that qualified for the ballot. And then we elected a new mayor, and Mayor Murray took this up as a big issue, convened a working group of stakeholders, and they thrashed through an agreement and brought it to the City Council. And we pretty much stayed consistent with what that agreement was. You know, the argument used with us by the mayor and others was we spent the time doing the homework here and working through all the various issues. So City Council, don't tinker too much. Just make sure it gets passed. And, you know, a vast majority of us, all of us basically, were supportive of the principle. So once we worked through everything, it was adopted and off we go.
What we now need to do is reverse the complex and complicated set of overlapping factors that caused America to go in the wrong direction and start becoming a low-wage nation. You've now had a 40-year laboratory experiment with whether trickle-down economics works. And it doesn't. What we now understand, we were misled. We were lied to, and we were had, is what happened. It is not just one political party that did it to us. It was a confluence of factors. So if we phased in a national $15 minimum wage, it would result in a significant reduction in poverty, a significant reduction in inequality. It would result in significant improvements in our national health.
The fight over what people get paid at work, the fight over wages, the fight over the minimum wage, is not just a federal fight that happens in Congress. Turns out it's a fight that happens everywhere. It's a decision for every business owner, from Punch pizza-sized businesses in Minneapolis up to Costco-size, up to the biggest employers in the country. And so every CEO, every employer now has that decision to make. Also, every mayor, every governor, the head of every agency that has control over how much its people earn an hour. The political fight over the minimum wage is now everybody's political fight. And it is already starting to work.
Well, I think that the $15 movement can be an example for other movements that have been feeling like they're stuck, that they're in a position where they've gotten themselves in a place of small incremental change. And the great example of what 15 has done is it's a reminder that sometimes you need to completely reimagine what you're doing and ask for much bigger and bolder and not limit yourself. And I think all social change movements can learn from that example. And we're really lucky to have watched this play out and watch it kind of move across the country. And I think we're going to see other movements ought to look to that example to say, maybe I'm not asking for enough. Maybe I should be asking for much more. And maybe that will allow me to inspire people to come and do something really, really big and bold.
So we're all patting ourselves on the back here in Seattle that we passed a $15 minimum wage. We have paid sick leave. We're showing the rest of the country how to do it. What's the future look like 10, 15, 20 years from now? Do we get higher wages for all workers? Do we slide back? And if so, what are the consequences?
Well, I mean, I'm an optimist, and I think we're going to take down the the trickle down crew. I think that, you know, they've had 30 years to prove this theory. It's been a catastrophe for 99% of Americans. I would say it's been a catastrophe for almost everybody. You know, I think that, you know, it's a new day, and I think we have a lot of opportunity to change the nature of economic policy and the way in which we manage our economy. You know, I think the future is very, very bright. I think that our country is the most innovative place on the planet already, and I think that an economy that includes more people more robustly will become even more innovative still. You know, putting in place a set of policies that benefit people generally is likely to lead to, you know, an era of prosperity and growth and economic stability in the country that may be unprecedented in our history. And so, you know, I'm very bullish about the future. And I think that, you know, it's just going to take a bunch of work and discipline to get there. But I don't see any reason why we can't.
And if you lose and income inequality continues to grow?
Well, I'll fly my jet to New Zealand and leave the rest of you to it, I guess.
The Other Washington is a production of Civic Skunk Works.
Thanks to our guests, David Rolfe, Zach Silk, Shama Sawan, Tim Burgess, Sterling Harders, and our benevolent plutocratic overlord, Nick Hanauer.
This show is produced by Tina Knoll at Large Media with help from Nick Casella. Our sound engineer is Shelley Goncharowski.
For more on the $15 minimum wage, you can find us on social media at Civic Skunk Works on Twitter and Facebook.
Visit our blog, civicskunkworks.com, where you can also subscribe to this show. Subscribe to our program. Go to iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts.
And thanks for listening.